with Rahab, the harlot, who is mentioned in Hebrews 11, 30 and 31, and also in James chapter 2, verses 25 and 26. She's mentioned quite often in the New Testament. Some think she's mentioned in Matthew 1, 5. Now, the name is spelled a little different there, but I personally believe she is mentioned there, and that is the genealogy of Christ. What does it do to your theology about the Jews' nationality and their emphasis on being Jewish when one of the ancestors of the Messiah is a Canaanite prostitute? Well, I think God just did it on purpose. There are several women mentioned in the genealogies. One is Tamar, who was raped by her father. Well, not raped, but had an incestuous relationship with her father-in-law, Judah. The other one is Ruth, who is a Moabitess. And then we have Rahab the harlot. Rahab is mostly talked about in the book of Joshua, of course. We're going to be dealing with Joshua 2 and Joshua 6 today. Rabbinical Judaism has made a big deal out of Rahab the harlot. Matter of fact, she becomes one of the most beautiful women in the world. Rabbinical Judaism says she's one of the four most beautiful women. They say she became a prostitute at age 10, and that's how she knew all the foreign secrets, because she was a prostitute of the king's. It is said that when all this was over, she married Joshua and became the ancestress to eight prophets, including Jeremiah and Huldah, which, now this is all rabbinical Judaism. It's nowhere in the Bible, really. So they really put her up on a pedestal as a prime example of the power of repentance. And I can certainly see how that would be a good example. Other branch of rabbinical Judaism are real nervous about having a harlot in the line of their prophets, so they make her an innkeeper. That comes from the Targums, but really it just won't hold. The lady was a prostitute. And let's get the text then. Joshua chapter 2, verses 1 through 14 first. Then Joshua, son of Nun, sent two men as spies secretly. Now, of course, the word Joshua is exactly the same word as Jesus. Now, there's no J in Hebrew. It's Yeshua, which means Yahweh saves. The prophet named Hosea is the name salvation. If you had the covenant name for God, Yeshua, on to Hosea, you get Joshua, and that's where it comes from. It means Yahweh saves. And the second idea here, I think, is important, is where he sent two men secretly. Now, possibly, is the nature of the mission. He didn't let anybody know he was sending two spies in the land. But the other thing is that the Jews have had such bad luck with these spies. Remember, the first time they sent spies, the whole nation had to wander in the wilderness 40 years. And only Joshua and Caleb had a good report. So Joshua only sent two. And I bet he picked the most trusted men he had to go check this city of Jericho out, to see how it was fortified and how it was laid out and all of that. Notice what it says from Shittim. Now, Shittim is a word that means Achaia. Now, if you look at Numbers 33:49, it says Abel Shittim, which means the stream of the Achaias. Now, Achaia wood is a very dark, very hard wood that's used extensively in the tabernacle. Now, Shittim is on the eastern side of the Jordan River. I hope you'll turn the back of your Bible to the maps that are there. It's right across from Jericho, north of the Dead Sea, in what's known as the Plains of Moab. Now, this particular site is where Moses delivered the book of Deuteronomy from. It's very close to Mount Nebo, where Moses died, and before he did, could see the part of the Promised Land. This also was a place and a scene of great idolatry for Israel. You might want to see Numbers 25:1, where they played the harlot there with the Baal. And so it's time to move on now to the Promised Land. We're setting the stage here. Now, notice where it says, go and view the land, especially Jericho. Now, Jericho is the oldest city in this part of the world. I think Damascus is probably the second oldest city, but Jericho has a documented settlement from, way, way back. Now, there's not much help for us archaeologically from the city about this particular Israeli invasion. There is much archaeological evidence about the destruction of many other Canaanite cities at about the time of the conquest, which would be about 1250, somewhere around that. But it's not for certain about Jericho. The ruins have been so badly deteriorated as far as weather-wise, wind and rain, that it's very hard to get any archaeological absolutes in the sense of good, verifiable material. Now, that's what it says, and they went and came to the house of a harlot. Now, where else in town would they be least recognized? I mean, people thought nothing of strangers coming and staying at the house of a harlot. So this is the place that they would go to kind of try to conceal themselves, all right? Whose name was Rahab. The name means, some think it means storm, but I really don't think that fits real well. It means a wide place. And from the term wide place came other ideas of being big-headed. So some think it means arrogant or proud. Some refer it to the marketplace, the wide place where the market was, where she worked. We just don't know, but that's what it means, wide place. Now, notice where we continue, and it says, and it was told the king of Jericho. Now, the common political setup in the Canaanite were city-states, somewhat like Greek states, but a little less organized than that. And it was a king of Jericho. I tell you, would you be nervous if about 15 miles from your city was a camp of over 1 million foreigners, and they had heard, apparently, what they were going to do, come and take the promised land. So this king was very nervous about the Israelis. Behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight and search out the land. How do you think they knew they were from Israel, sons of Israel? Well, either it was their dress that distinguished them, or maybe their accent that distinguished them, or maybe they bought some characteristic kind of food like grits. You know, I don't know how they knew, but somehow these guys knew they were from Israel and not Canaanite people. Now, notice what it mentions in verse 3. The king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out the land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them, and she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they came from. Now, let me ask you a question. Ethically speaking, does this woman lying to save the life of these two spies, is that ethical? Does the end justify the means? Well, you can say, well, she's not a real believer yet, and that's why she can lie and get away with it. Well, I don't know, but she does really lie here. Notice where she hid them, and she had brought them up on the roof and hidden them in the flax of stacks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. Now, flax is the material that linen is made from. In certain times of the year, it has to be dried. It's kind of placed in stacks to dry out. So the possible date for Jericho would be March or April when the flax would be drying. On the roofs is an interesting word because Oriental society is basically lived on the roofs of houses. Matter of fact, some of the rabbis would say that there is a roof road clear across Jerusalem. That's where people slept at night in the summertime when it was hot. That's where they had their ate their dinners. That's where they worked. That's where they had their social gathering, where they were married, up on those roofs. And this is where the flat was stacked. Surprises me because all the roofs are flat. You could see clear across the whole city, so she must have hit them at dark in those flax. Don't you think that was miserable, staying there for a long time in the middle of that flax? Yucko. Well, verse 7. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords. Now, these are the places that are shallow enough to cross these streams. There were no bridges in this day. It'd be somewhere close to where the Jordan empties into the Dead Sea. Now, look at verse 8. Now, before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. What does anything seem funny about this verse to you? How does this Canaanite prostitute know the covenant name of God, Yahweh? Because that's what she says, Lord. See all the caps there? How does she know the name of God that's supposed to be revealed just to Moses down in Egypt? I mean, how? Well, apparently she had heard of some of these accounts of them wandering in the wilderness. I'm sure the Israelites came across many caravans and people going through there, and they had told the stories about this large group of people that were wandering, and she had heard about it. She knew about it, and she not only knew the covenant name of God, but she knew that God had promised to give them the land. Now, how did she know that? Maybe back to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Maybe it was something that was culturally known. This lady knows quite a lot about God and what he's doing with the nation of Israel. Now, notice what she asked him. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea. How would they have heard that? I don't know. Before you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, Sihon and Og. Now that they would have known from personal experience. Those were nations and kings that were very close to them, and they heard how they were completely destroyed. And Og is a giant, and yet he was destroyed. Whom you utterly destroyed. Now this is the Hebrew word harim. It's sometimes translated in English under the ban or the korban. It is a word that is related etymologically to the word for harem, which means those women set apart for a certain person. Well, it's the idea of being set apart for a certain purpose or task. Here, it is the idea of a holy war. Now, many people have wondered about how can the God, who is so compassionate and loving, order the complete annihilation of a city like Jericho. Under the ban means that everything that breathes dies. Chickens, cows, pregnant women, little children, old men, everybody dies. Well, that is horrendous to our ethical sensibilities. We must remember that we cannot judge the Bible in the light of the ethics or customs in our days. Too often we look back at Eric and say, well, they did that, they're just civilized. That was the way it was done in all the cultures, this holy war aspect. You might want to see Genesis 15:16, where God says it's in judgment on the Amorites that it happened, not just favoritism toward the Jews. You might want to see the book of Leviticus, where the idea of being set apart to God is a very special, holy thing. You know, I think a good example might be we criticize them for doing that. But you know, when they look at our society, Orientals, and see how we treat our elderly people, they're horrified that we claim to be so civilized and put our old folks in homes and treat them the way we do. So we need to get off our soapbox. Cultures differ, and God deals with people as much as they can understand, as much as they can take of revelation. I think we put God in a three-piece suit, and they would put him in an Oriental throne as an Oriental monarch. We must realize that we're influenced by our culture, and it does somehow color how we understand and what we can understand of God. Notice where, in verse 11, and when they heard it, their hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is the God in heaven above and the earth beneath. My word, what kind of theological statement is this lady making? She is saying that God is the Yahweh is the creator God. That's so unusual because every one of these kingdoms had their own national God. And yet here we are with this lady affirming that God is the creator of heaven and earth, the transcendent God as well as the immanent God. She really knows quite a bit about God and is willing to commit herself by faith. That's what James picks up on in James chapter 2, verses 25 and 26, when he says, you can tell this lady was really saved because her works justified her faith. It seems that she already had some degree of faith, and she exercised that faith in protecting the spies. And in James' way of thinking, that's what verified her faith. And so she is one of the prime examples, not only of repentance, but of justification by faith that results in appropriate actions. Now, verse 12. Now, therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth. Now, the word swear here is a rather unusual word for us. When we think swearing in our culture, we think cussing, you know. But swearing by God was a part of the worship and ritual of the nation of Israel. And what she's saying to them, I want you to swear by God. I want you to cross your heart and hope to die, stick a needle in your eye kind of stuff, you know. Swear on a stack of Bibles. She wants them to say in God's name that they're going to deal with her rightly and kindly. Now, the word here, deal kindly with me, is nothing less than the Hebrew word hesed, which is usually translated love and kindness in New American Standard, or mercy in King James, which is that special covenant covenant word for God's covenant loyalty or fidelity. She wants them to swear that kind of loyalty and covenant love to her in God Yahweh's name. Well, she's putting a bite on them. She wants some verification here. Notice where it says a pledge of truth. She wants some token or sign that they're telling the truth. Remember in Tamar, she asked for Judah's staff or something to, Judah didn't have any money, and she wanted something to verify that he had been with her. It later saved her life. Now, it seems from this account that what the spies are going to give her is this red rope that she let them down over the wall with. She's to hang out the window on the inside so that the Israeli soldiers will know where her house is and will not kill those who are there. So they get a pledge. Notice he says, spare my father and mother and my brothers and my sisters and all who belong with them. She wants her whole tribe or clan or family, at least, in the city spared. So the men said to her, our life for yours if you do not tell this business of ours. They're saying, you save us, you scratch our back, we'll scratch yours, kind of thing. And it shall come about when the Lord gives us the land that we will deal kindly and faithfully. Now, there's the word, usually the same word for faith. It means trustworthiness with you. So she let them down with a rope, and on we go. The account of the fall of Jericho is very interesting. We just don't have time today to cover that. Now let's go, before we go to chapter 6, let me give you a chance to send off for some other teaching tapes in this area. I have exegeted the whole book of Joshua, for that matter, the whole book of Deuteronomy, verse by verse through every chapter. It's available on tape in the catalog that our announcer is going to mention to you right now.
Thank you for watching today. Bob will return in just a moment. We at the International Sunday School Lesson would like to take this opportunity to offer you a weekly exegetical outline of these Sunday School lessons free. This includes historical background, word and phrase study, and discussion questions. All we need is your address. Now, here is ours. International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas, 79408. Also, there is available free and postage paid the catalog of Bob's teachings on cassette tapes. This catalog includes over 900 subjects. We will be happy to send it to you this week so that you can order the tapes that interest you. Now here's our address again. International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas, 79408.
Thank you, Theo. Now let's go to Joshua chapter 6 and look at 22 through 25, okay? This is where it says, and Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the harlot's house and bring out the woman and all that she has out there as you have sworn to her. Now, Jericho was a unique kind of walled city. It was a very powerful city. Jericho gets its name. It's called the City of Palms, but the word Jericho means fragrance. It was an oasis, a beautifully green area close to the Jordan River Valley. Known for its dates and figs and those kind of things. Matter of fact, when Jesus entered Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, if it was palms they used, the only place in the whole area that has palm trees is Jericho. Now, it was surrounded with a double wall. As you remember, the whole idea of the Israelites walking around the city 7 days, blowing the trumpet one time, then walking around seven times on the seventh day and blowing the trumpet from the wall. Can't you imagine those Israeli soldiers saying, this isn't going to work. We've never done this before like this. This is wild. Well, the walls fell down that day, but apparently Rahab's house did not fall. Now, remember, her house is built into the second wall, and apparently the rest of the walls fell down. The houses that were connected to the walls must have fallen also, or at least the gaps in between them. Her house must have been somewhat intact because the spies knew where to go to the house because of the red rope hanging out. And also a house was apparently still standing. Now, notice what it mentions in verse 23. So the young men who were the spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father and mother, her brothers, and all she had. Now, you might ask the question, why is Rahab's faith good enough to save her family? Well, you know, in chapter 7, we're going to deal with this Hebrew idea of corporality. It's so different from us. Achan is going to take something out of Jericho. Now, it's under the ban. It's dedicated to God. They can take no spoils out. But Achan takes some clothes and some other things out. When it's found out, the way it was found out is the Israeli army lost the battle the next day with a little bitty insignificant city called Ai. Several soldiers were killed, all because this one man violated this ban. Now, why would this man sin, kill several Israeli soldiers, and cause the whole army to lose? It's this Hebrew idea of corporality. It's so unusual for us because we're so geared toward individual response. When Achan's sin was found out, Achan's wife was killed with him. Achan's children were killed with him. Now, you can see how they may have been involved in this, have some duplicity in the affair, but Achan's cattle are killed. Now, how's the old moo-moo know what's happening, you know? Why kill the cow? The Hebrew concept of corporality. It's the same idea of original sin. In Adam, all of us somehow are involved in his rebellion. Now, to us in modern America, where we emphasize individual responsibility, it sounds very foreign to us, but it is a biblical emphasis. Now, the Old Testament does hit the idea of individual responsibility, especially in Ezekiel 18 and Jeremiah 31. But here, it's the corporate sense. The nation of Israel is committed to God. Now, it's individuals in the nation whose heart is right with God, but it's the whole nation viewed as a whole. So here, this woman's faith somehow covers or incorporates her whole family. Notice what it says. Let's see. Oh, the last part of verse 23. And place them outside the camp of Israel. Well, see, they are still ceremonially unclean. These are Canaanite people. Uncircumcised people, maybe, even. But for anyway, Canaanites. You might well see Deuteronomy 23:14. So they had to stay outside the camp until they became official proselytes, until they'd done all the days of ceremonial washing and cleanliness, and then they were incorporated back into the nation of Israel. Now, notice where in verse 24 it says, and they burned the city with fire and all that was in it, only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and irons they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. Now, many commentators say, aha, here we have an anachronism. It says the house of the Lord, the temple wasn't even built yet. Of course it wasn't. This reference refers through these early books, to the tabernacle that Moses was instructed to make in the wilderness. It doesn't have anything to do with the temple. And so I think we just need to realize that. Then, let's see, notice where it mentions, however, Rahab the whore and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared, and she lived in the midst of Israel to this day. Now, isn't that a unique little idea there? She lived in the midst of Israel this day. That tells me that the early parts of the Bible, were, especially Joshua, was written by somebody in Joshua's day. Whether Joshua wrote it for sure or not, I'm not certain. But isn't that a neat little kind of idea? She lives here with us to this day. It's kind of like saying, well, she just lived down the street. I saw her at the market yesterday. If you don't believe it, go ask her. This, to me, shows, the Bible through and through has these little bitty things that shows the historicity of the Bible. Modern source criticism that divides the Bible up into many sources, J-E-B-P, and even has a hexateuch sometime instead of a pentateuch, and tries to make it written much later, I think it shows the presupposition of those scholars instead of the account itself. And she hid the messengers whom Joshua had sent to spy out Jericho. Well, notice verse 26 where it says, and Joshua made them take an oath. Again, this idea of taking an oath is very common in the Old Testament. What it does, when these spies took an oath to protect her, when Joshua takes an oath, it brings God into the agreement. And therefore, to violate it is to violate God. It's a way of making sure you don't take God's name in vain. The Old Testament doesn't ever ask us to take a vow or take an oath. It doesn't ever say take an oath. But boy, when we take one, it says you better pay it. Better you never to make an oath than to make one and not pay it or vow. So it's a very serious thing. And they judge much of their legal, judicial life, much of their religious life is involved in taking these oaths. It came to be a real problem in Jesus' day because the rabbis had made a distinction. They'd say, well, you can swear by heaven or swear by God's throne. And there's a distinction. If you swear by heaven, it's binding. If you swear by God's throne, it's not binding. And so they made a real elaborate distinction between oaths that were binding and oaths that were not. That's why Jesus just finally said to the Christians, look, let your yes be yes and your no be no. And that's what he's talking about. The book of Joshua is an extremely interesting book. I wish that we had more time to cover it. But, of course, what we're doing is picking up personalities from the 11th chapter of Hebrews and going back into Joshua. But if you are interested in Joshua, it is available on tape. I think it's covers about 15 90-minute cassette tapes. And it's exegeted there. If you enjoy the study of the conquest, then I hope you'll write me in that catalog and send off for it. Let's look, if we could, briefly at Hebrews chapter 11, those last two verses, and see exactly how it fits in the context of our current study through Hebrews. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. For by faith Rahab the harlot did not persist along those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Now here it shows a real change of life. And then James picks up on it a little bit later about that her her actions showed the validity of her decision. And I think James has a valid point there. To say, well, I once accepted Christ or I once prayed, but to live a life totally of selfishness and totally away from God with habitual sin, be it the characteristic of the life, is to tell me probably you didn't meet the Lord. That's why I think 1 John 3:6-9 says habitual sin is a sign that that you never knew Him. So I think Rahab's a good example of that. It's amazing to me that she's in the line of the Messiah. That's what irked those rabbinical genealogists to have a Canaanite prostitute in the line of the Messiah. I think it shows the universal love and forgiveness of God. Well, I've so enjoyed being with you. I hope you'll write for the free outline if you don't already have it. And anybody you know who would like this outline, it's free and we'll mail it to them. See you again, same time, same place, next week.
Listening to the International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated with your host, Pastor Teacher Bob Utley. Be sure to write for our free weekly outline. The address, International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas 79408. And join us next week at the same time for the International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated.
A very high position, a technical position. He may have even been in line of being Pharaoh, but he chose to identify himself with his Hebrew slave brethren. Because he preferred to suffer hardships for the people of God than the passing enjoyment of results from sin. I want you to know sin does have its enjoyments for a season, but it always, in the end, brings death. And Moses knew that, and he left all the court of Pharaoh to follow God. And though the reproach endured for Christ was greater than the wealth of all the treasures of Egypt, for he kept an eye upon the reward. You see, he looked to the future, to the spiritual realm. For by faith he left Egypt. Some have the word Exodus there, but it's really the word Egypt. I don't think it's the Exodus experience at all. I think it's when he left and ran into the country of Midian, where he met his future wife, Zipporah, and Jethro, her father. Now, because he was not afraid of the king's anger. You might want to see Exodus 2:14-15, where it says he was afraid. This author knew the text real well, and apparently he didn't think that's exactly what it meant, or he's reinterpreting it. Look at verse 28. For by faith he instituted the Passover and the pouring of blood on the doorposts, so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. This follows the Septuagint translation, where in Exodus 12:23, the destroyer is the angel that came that night. The destroyer of death angels mentioned often in the Old Testament. Our cultural concept of the grim reaper is not a biblical thing. The person the angel who comes to people's death is a messenger of God, not the evil one. I'm running out of time. Verse 29. By faith they crossed the Red Sea, Exodus 14:21 and following. The Egyptians were drowned. I personally think they crossed up close to the marshy land, close to the Mediterranean Sea. The real miracle was that all those Egyptians drowned in such shallow water. But I think that's where they crossed, not the Red Sea as we know it. In the Hebrew, it's the Sea of Yom Suf, the Sea of Reeds. Now, by faith, the walls of Jericho collapsed. Joshua 6:20, 2 Corinthians 10:4. They went around it 7 times, blew the trumpet, the walls fell down. You might want to remember that story. Notice in verse 31, Rahab the prostitute. Later translations have tried to lower this, but she's a Gentile and she's a prostitute. She's also in the line of the Messiah. You might want to see that in the book of Joshua there, Joshua 2, I think. Let's skip down to verse 32. We mentioned Gideon, Barak, Samson, Japheth, David, Samuel. These are a little out of order. He seems to put the most important ones first or connect them together chronologically. I'm not going to... Let me just skip through here and tell you some things.
stoned to death may refer to the tradition about Jeremiah or 2 Chronicles 24, 21, and 22. The word about sawn in two, we don't know anybody who was sawed in two, but the tradition says Isaiah was. When it says kill with a sword, we might want to see Jeremiah 26, 23 or 1 Kings 19, 10. But notice these people who live by faith, some of them died terrible deaths. This is not a promise we'll have an easy life to say we live by faith. It's a promise that God is involved in our life. And though somehow we cannot see him right now, and though somehow maybe our lives don't show his presence, God's really with us. He's made some promises and commitment to us. And we need to live our lives in that kind of faith day by day. It starts with a point of action and continues through life. The examples here in chapter 11 combines Paul's use of justification by faith with James' use of it by your works, your faith is verified or proven. These men held out to the end. Some of them died. Some of them were blessed. Some were tortured. Some were cut in two. Some received partial reward. We live our lives. We put all our eggs in God's basket. Though the circumstances around us don't seem to reflect God's blessing, we believe by faith that God is with us and it's all going to work out in the end. That's the lives of faith. And that is the example of faith that's meant to spur us on today, as well as those Jewish Christians in the first century, encourage them to hang in there, though the circumstances of persecution were bad. I hope you'll hang in there, too. God bless you. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.